This is James Stoker. Today is February 23rd, 2011. I'm talking with Paul Gonson, who served as solicitor of the Securities and Exchange Commission from 1979 to 1998, and since then has served as a member of the firm K&L Gates. Our subject is the role of the Supreme Court in shaping securities regulation in the United States. Welcome, Paul.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to do this oral history for the SEC Historical Society. I think it's an interesting subject, and I'm pleased to have been asked to do it.
Well, we're real happy to have you here. So when you were a law student, did you ever think that you would argue cases in front of the Supreme Court?
Well, no, I never did, but I'm very happy to have reached that point in life where I have. And I did look up my yearbook, and in the yearbook it indicates, what would you like to do, what kind of career would you like to have? And a lot of people put general practice, and I wrote constitutional law. So I guess I did have some idea at the early stage that's what I wanted to do.
While you were a student, did you do an internship or a clerkship in the federal courts?
No, I didn't. I wish I had, but I was drafted in the Army in those days, this was back in the 50s, for 2 years, and then went in to work for a law firm in Buffalo, New York, my ancestral homeland.
Mm-hmm. And did you work there involve securities?
Not very much, although I then started a law firm together with two other good friends, old friends, classmates of mine. And we did a little bit of securities law. And looking back, I think we were probably violating the securities law while we were doing it. We were in Buffalo, and we were handling matters in Cleveland, Ohio, which wasn't very far from Buffalo, and up in Canada, which was only across the Niagara River. And thus we were involved both in interstate and international work, and oblivious to the fact that that had some implications that we were then not aware of.
Mm-hmm. So in your early years of work at the SEC, did you work on Supreme Court cases at all?
Actually, I did fairly early. I came to the SEC in 1961, and by the middle 60s, I was already involved in quite a few appellate cases, although not in the Supreme Court, in U.S. Courts of Appeals. But there was a case early on where I did go to the Supreme Court, more as a junior lawyer working on a brief with more senior lawyers. And then gradually, relatively early, I got involved in Supreme Court cases in a junior capacity, and of course, over the years, moved up into more senior positions.
Do you remember what the first case before the Supreme Court was that you worked on?
Yes. The first case was called Kaplan versus Anderson. It was a case involving the reorganization under the Bankruptcy Act of a company called TMT Trailer, Inc. TMT Trailer stood for Transmarine Transportation. It was first venture in what was called piggyback freight hauling. As you know, sometimes freight cars on railroads sit on flatbed and are pulled along. Where this was an idea where they were going to put these containerized trade in ocean-going vessels and carry them that way. The company got into trouble under the bankruptcy organization. I remember asking the clerk of the court what TMT stood for. He told me, too much time and too much trouble. That was his point of view. But that case went to the Supreme Court, and there's an interesting colloquy set forth in the opinion of the Supreme Court between me and the district judge, the federal judge, and that was the basis on which the Supreme Court reversed him. So here I am quoted in the Supreme Court case. That was very thrilling for me.
How old were you at that point?
Oh, probably in my early 30s.
Oh, that's quite young.
Yeah, relatively.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk for a minute in general terms about the role of the judicial system in financial relation or regulation. Why does so much of the SEC's work end up in the courts, and in particular before the Supreme Court?
Well, I guess there's two or three reasons. So the first reason is that whatever the SEC does is subject to judicial review. That is, under the laws it administers, people don't like the way they have acted or rules they have promulgated or cases that they've brought against persons who have lost those cases, why recourse is available to the courts. And sometimes recourse is available to trial courts, sometimes directly to a court of appeals. And, of course, eventually some of these cases will reach the U.S. Supreme Court.
So this is in cases of enforcement?
These are enforcement cases where the SEC brings lawsuits against people. But there are also challenges that can be brought in court to SEC rulemaking, specifically provided by statute. And in addition to that, there are cases that are appeals from adverse decisions by administrative law judges within the SEC. Those are also appealable to courts of appeals. Then there are a variety of other cases under the Administrative Procedure Act, even Freedom of Information Act appeals. If someone asks for information from the SEC, didn't get it, can then appeal, of course, from the denial. And then there are a handful of cases which are defensive cases. The SEC handles this, cases brought against it, and sometimes appeals are taken from those cases. So there are a variety of cases which may or may not reach the Supreme Court. The statistics are interesting. Every year the court takes probably at most 100 cases to be decided on the merits, and there are approximately 3,000 requests for review. So one can readily see that the number of cases are small, and the chance of getting to the Supreme Court is also relatively small.
What percentage of securities-related cases in federal court end up going before the Supreme Court?
Are you talking about securities cases or general?
Well, securities cases.
Securities cases. Yeah. A relatively large percentage, notwithstanding the very small statistical percent, as I mentioned, 100 or less out of 3,000 requests. When the government asks the court to take a case, or the government responds to somebody else's request that it thinks the case is important, then the odds of granting review go way up, usually over 50%. So the chances are more than one out of two that the court will hear the case.
Within the SEC, how was the solicitor's office organized to deal with Supreme Court cases? Were there certain individuals that were tasked only with the Supreme Court, or did appellate lawyers work in all the different courts on different times?
The latter is true, Dr. Stoker. There are a group of lawyers who specialize within the general counsel's office in appellate work. And these lawyers do appeals, of course, to courts of appeals, and they also handle cases in the Supreme Court. And generally, they sort of follow the case. So if they've been working on a case in the Court of Appeals and that case eventuates to the Supreme Court, then the same staff stays with that case. And to some extent, it's the luck of the draw as to which cases will end up there.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about the role of the SEC in private cases for the court? Oftentimes it files front of the court briefs, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
We say in Latin amicus curiae or amicus briefs. The SEC has a very active role in amicus briefs and sometimes even arguing cases in the Supreme Court. The way it works is something like this. Private actions under the securities laws are viewed by the SEC sometimes as a supplement to their own law enforcement cases. After all, the SEC is a relatively small agency given the size of the U.S. government, and it administers and regulates the huge securities markets. So it views private actions as sometimes a necessary supplement to its own law enforcement actions. Furthermore, the SEC is, for the most part, unable to recover damages for investors who've been injured, whereas, of course, investors can obtain these damages in private actions. So for those reasons, the SEC generally supports private actions. The procedure is that sometimes a request will be made by a court for the SEC to come in. It's not unusual for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, Federal Appellate Court in New York, to ask the SEC to come in and give their views on a certain subject they might find difficult. The Supreme Court, several times during the year, will issue an order, typical one-line order, to the Solicitor General, who is a senior official of the Department of Justice. The Solicitor General is the person who handles the Supreme Court cases for the U.S. government in the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And that one-sentence order will say the Solicitor General is invited to submit its views on this such-and-such case. And if the case involves securities, of course it could be any kind of case, then typically the Solicitor General will then ask the SEC to draft a brief that would respond to the court's invitation.
Mm-hmm.
More often, however, the SEC on its own initiative keeps its ear to the ground, sort of follows litigation, private litigation in the country, particularly important litigation, and seeks on its own initiative to enter these cases.
Was this a practice before you became solicitor?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Well, and about how many amicus briefs are filed a year, would you say?
Good.
It may change from year to year.
Oh, in all courts now, and not just the Supreme Court, my guess would be around 40 or 50, mm-hmm. quite a few.
Okay. Do you think that number changed during your time as solicitor? Do you think you filed maybe more or fewer than the previous solicitor?
My guess is it was about the same. And I think since I retired in 1998, mm-hmm. and my former deputy, with whom I worked closely for many, many years, became solicitor, I think that practice has continued. And so I think it runs about the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk for a minute about different subject areas in which the Supreme Court has played an important role. First, the definition of security. When you joined the SEC, you must have been aware that the question of the definitions of securities was likely to be a difficult question that you would face time and time again in court.
Yes, it was. It's very interesting that the securities laws do contain a definitional section defining what a security is. And it will say, for example, a security is a stock, a bond, a note, a certificate of indebtedness, an investment contract, and so on. But even those definitions are then subject to different kinds of constructions. And there were some cases early on the definition of security that went to the Supreme Court. In those days, relatively early days, the Courts of Appeals had a very restrictive view of what was a security. And so novel or unique kinds of transactions were held not to be securities. So in the first five cases that went to the Supreme Court on the definition of securities, the Courts of Appeals had held in every one of those cases that the transaction was not a security, and in every one of those cases, the Supreme Court reversed and held that it was a security. One of those cases was a case called Joiner, and that was an interesting case where promoters were selling interests in land adjacent to operating oil wells. And the pitch was not that the buyer was going to sink an oil well, but was going to benefit incidentally from the increase in the value of land because it was located next to an oil well. The SEC said that that was a security. And the court said, no, it's real estate. That is the lower court. The Supreme Court reversed and said, yes, that is a security. The next case was a very famous case called Howey, which involved the definition of an investment contract in the definitional section of what is a security. And there, a promoter was selling orange groves in Florida together with a contract to harvest and market the oranges. So it wasn't expected that any of these buyers were actually going to go down to Florida, you know, and pick their oranges. So what they were doing was they had a combination of having bought a small piece of that Orange Grove and a contract to manage it. The lower court again said that this was real estate, not a security. The Supreme Court said, no, it is a security because it's an investment of money in a joint enterprise with the results and the profits that come from the efforts of others.
That's the so-called Howey test.
That's the very famous Howey test, still used today. Very, very important test. The next two cases were insurance cases. One was called SEC versus Variable Annuity Life Insurance Company, and the acronym was VALIC, so it's called the VALIC case. And the next case, shortly after that, was SEC versus United Benefit Life. And in those cases, there were insurance policies that were sold where the return on the policy was not based on the life of the insured. It was based upon the results of investments in the stock market. And these were called variable annuities, which was why the company was called, I guess, the Variable Annuity Company. And these variable annuities were held to be securities because the results were dependent on the stock market moves. So the Supreme Court held in those cases that they were securities. And in the fifth case, a case called Trepnin versus Knight, the Supreme Court held that withdrawable shares in a credit union were securities. They were akin, I guess, to stock in a company. Okay. So those were the five cases in what we sometimes call the expansion area or expansion phase of the definition.
Were all of these cases before you joined the solicitor's office?
These were all before I joined. No, I guess Trepanin, no. Joyner and Howey were, the two insurance cases and Trepanin were after that time. Okay. The modern era, I like to call
it. Okay. So after Truckman v. Knight, what changed?
Well, then it was really interesting. Now, you know, the message is being given to the lower courts that the Supreme Court in these decisions, obviously, is being very expansive in the definition of securities. So they get the word, and now they start, they being trial courts and federal courts of appeals, they start construing the transactions before them as securities. And then the Supreme Court enters, sometimes scholars call it, the pendulum swings back again. And now we have a more restrictive era where the Supreme Court takes these cases where the courts of appeals have held they were securities and reverses them and says, no, they're not securities.
And this is beginning in the 1970s or when?
Around the 1970s, okay. That's correct. Uh-huh. And that coincides, I might say, with the arrival in the Supreme Court of Justice Powell. I don't mean to suggest that Justice Powell was the sole influence, but he was a very influential person on the court. Justice Powell had been a corporate and securities lawyer in Richmond, Virginia, and was the only justice on the court that had a background in corporate and securities mm-hmm. law. And necessarily he was influential with his colleagues, none of whom had a similar background. He also was a very conservative man, and his opinions reflect a certain conservatism.
Did you ever meet Justice Powell?
I did, as a matter of fact. I met him on several occasions. I was once master of ceremonies in a program at the Supreme Court in which he was speaker, and I introduced him, and mm-hmm. I have a nice photograph of me and Justice Powell.
Was this while you were solicitor?
Yes, it was. The first case, this what I call the restrictive case, was a case called the Foreman case. And that was a case where the state of New York had passed a law giving special benefits to low-cost housing. And based on this law, a huge development was built in the Bronx called Co-op City. And in order to get an apartment in that development, this was a co-op development, sort of peculiar to New York and only a handful of other states, one had to buy stock in that co-op. And the stock was based on, you bought the number of shares, dependent upon the number of rooms in your apartment. So if you're buying a five-room apartment, you buy five shares of stock. The SEC had taken, this was a private action. In this private action, persons who had bought this stock and who fell out for one reason or another became disillusioned with the apartment, took the position that this was a security. The stock was a security, and that they should have been given a lot of more information than they were given. And then they sued the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York held that it was a security. The Supreme Court reversed and said, no, it's not a security, it's real estate. What this was an effort by the state of New York to provide low-cost housing, and it's just a peculiarity of the way you get into the housing that you have to buy, quote, stock, unquote. Then they defined what the attributes of stock were, which would exclude this kind of stock purchase. There was an interesting byplay. Justice Powell spoke with a soft southern accent. He was a very gracious gentleman. But when I argued that case for the SEC, and when I argued that a provision in the securities law called the intrastate exemption for registration, that is, if stock is offered and sold only within one state, it doesn't have to be registered with the SEC, then that would have exempted this entire issue. He jumped all over me. I never saw him be so angry. And he said, don't you know that any lawyer worth his salt would never rely on that intrastate exemption, because just one incidental sale to an out-of-state person will avoid it, and then everybody will get in trouble. And it just reflected his own unique personal interest and knowledge of the securities laws. And I was really quite taken aback at this southern gentlemanly assault.
So what was the SEC's position in this case? Did the SEC
argue? The SEC agreed that it was a security.
Yes.
There had been one case in the Second Circuit and a second case following the Second Circuit, and there had been three judges on one panel, and the Second Circuit, three judges on the second panel. So you already had six federal judges saying it was a security. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a respectable number of judges to support the SEC's position.
Did you expect opposition from various members of the court to that?
Well, we did, yes. I mean, we're realists, and we expected that this would be uphill. And indeed, it did prove to be uphill because the court, as I said, did reverse. I always like to count the noses, although it doesn't help. The case, I think, was 6-3. So you had six Supreme Court justices saying it was not a security, and you had three saying it was. And when you added the three who dissented to the six in the Second Circuit, you had nine judges in favor of the position and only six opposed to it. But that's not the way the system works.
Was this your first time to argue before the court?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And how did you prepare for that?
Well, I prepared for it very studiously, as you can imagine. I used to prepare a notebook, which I would take with me. The notebook would have the argument I would give, but you never give the argument that you want to give. We lawyers like to say that if you're arguing the Supreme Court, you really make three arguments. The first argument you make is the argument you intend to make. The second argument you make is the argument you actually do make. And the third argument is when you walk out of the court, the argument you wish you had made. But the way it works in the Supreme Court is it's mostly a question and answer session. You get a few words out, you get your name out, maybe one or two opening sentences, and then some justice will ask a question, and another justice will ask another question, and it's all questions and answers. And the reason for it is you're not there to give a speech to impress your wife and kids and your parents who are in the audience. You're there to try to persuade the court, and the court is only interested in what it's interested in. So it's only going to ask you a question about what it thinks it wants to know. And the art, of course, is trying to weave in your answers an argument of the kind that you hope to make, the points that you hope to make. Also, you have to try to anticipate these questions. So the reason I used a notebook was I would anticipate as many questions as I could that might be asked, and then it would have a little page with the answer and a little tab. So if the question were asked, aha, I did have anticipated that, I would then flip the notebook, and then I would have notes to answer the question. But it's very impressive. As many times as I go to the Supreme Court, and others have said this too, one is always impressed with the majesty and the dignity of the court and what it stands for.
Within the SEC, did you have a team of people that were helping you to prepare for that?
Oh, yes, indeed, of course. This was a case in which the SEC had not participated in the lower courts, so we were for the first time in the case of the Supreme Court. Yes, there were a lot of helpers, and the SEC goes to the Supreme Court through the Solicitor General. And as I mentioned, the Solicitor General is a high official of the Department of Justice and represents the government and the Supreme Court. So in addition to having SEC lawyers being helpful, there are lawyers in the Solicitor General's office who also work on this brief and who, of course, are very experienced in Supreme Court practice, and they're very helpful.
So when you argued before the court, the Solicitor General was there with you at the time?
He was, yes. He's usually there for these court arguments.
Okay. Great. Well, it's very interesting to hear about that, the specific details of that experience. But and then what other cases during the 1970s also helped to further define the definition of security?
Well, there was an interesting case after that called Teamsters Union versus Daniel. Mr. Daniel was a truck driver, belonged to the Teamsters Union. The Teamsters Union had an interesting pension plan. Instead of each employer having a pension plan, the Teamsters Union had a union-wide pension plan, so that no matter who the truck driver drove for, the pension plan would be administered by the union, not by the particular employer, because sometimes truck drivers drove for different employers. So the pension plan provided that if you served 20 consecutive years in Teamster Union employment, you were then eligible for a pension. Mr. Daniel had had a break in service for a few months early in his career, and so when he retired after 20 years, he was told he was not going to get any pension. Obviously, he was quite disappointed, and eventually he sued the Teamsters Union on the ground that this pension agreement was a security, and he was successful in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals as the Federal Appellate Court in Chicago agreed with him. The Teamsters Union then appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reversed and held that it was not a security. It held generally that ERISA, which is the federal law governing pension plans, and the law concerning collective bargaining agreements, that is the labor laws, would be the laws that would apply, not the securities laws. And one did not need the overlap of the securities laws to this pattern of existing federal law. So it held it as not a security. Mm-hmm.
Now, this case was in 1979. Now, that's the same year you became solicitor, right?
Yes, it was.
So this must have been one of your first big cases to work on.
Well, it was a big case to work on. This was a case also in which, by the way, the Solicitor General supported the Labor Department, who opposed the argument that this was a definition of security.
So this was one of your first experiences with intergovernmental conflicts.
Yes, it was.
Right. Okay. What other cases took place during this restrictive phase that you're talking
about?
Well,
another case involving the definition of security was a case called Marine Bank versus Weaver. That case involved a question as to whether a certificate of deposit issued by a federally regulated bank and insured by the FDIC was a security. And in the lower courts, you know, it's funny that Supreme Court people always call all courts that are not the Supreme Court the lower courts. But in trial courts and in the courts of appeals, the SEC and the FDIC were on opposite sides of that question. The SEC was arguing that CDs are securities, and the FDIC was arguing that they were not. So when the case reached, one of those cases reached the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General who likes always to say that the U.S., United States should speak with one voice in the Supreme Court, didn't like the idea that we had this conflict between the banking agencies and the SEC. He certainly was not going to permit briefs to be filed in the Supreme Court by the federal agencies arguing against one another. So he put us, he put the general counsels of the SEC and the three bank regulatory agencies, the FDIC, the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Federal Reserve System, in a conference room in his suite. He locked the door and he says, "You guys aren't coming out until you reach a common position that we can assert to the Supreme Court." So after some arguing and pounding of the table, we finally did reach a common decision where each of us was going to be able then to sign this joint brief in the Supreme Court. And the common position was that CDs were not securities, but each of the agencies dropped quite a few footnotes in that brief reserving position. So the text of the brief said a CD was not a security, but the footnotes were giving all kinds of exceptions to the text. And from the SEC's point of view, there were two prominent footnotes. One footnote expressed a concern that if CDs are not securities, then money market mutual funds, which are regulated by the SEC, might not then be subject to SEC regulation under the Investment Company Act, because the Investment Company Act says that these mutual funds have to invest in securities. And these money market funds would buy CDs, and if they weren't securities, they may not be mutual funds and not subject to SEC regulation. And so we asked the court to say that in some circumstances, CDs would be securities. And the second footnote had to do with what are referred to as jumbo CDs. There was then, still is, a big market for bank certificates of deposit issued by brokerage firms in denominations of more than $100,000 or larger. And these jumbo CDs, of course, issued by brokers, are instruments the SEC felt it ought to be able to regulate because it ought to be regulating the brokerage industry that sells them. And so it argued in that second footnote that there should be jurisdiction there too. So when the Supreme Court decided the case, the Supreme Court held, as all four agencies had said, that CDs issued by a federally regulated bank and insured by the FDIC were not securities, but then went on to say that in some circumstances they could be, which was a great line. And thereafter, to make it was now becoming a long story short, the money market funds were held to be investing in securities, and these CDs were securities. And in a subsequent case called Gary Plastic versus Merrill Lynch, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit held that where Merrill Lynch was selling these jumbo CDs under circumstances where they agreed to redeem them and to make a market so that they could be resold before maturity, that they were secured. Mm-hmm. So the two footnotes actually did help.
So in that second case, you were the SEC was arguing against Merrill Lynch.
No, in the second okay. Well, the DC in the, that was it. Excuse me, that was a case in the Second Circuit when right. The SEC did not participate.
Oh, did not
I'm
participate.
Just talking about the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yep. So then after Marine Bank v. Weaver, the Supreme Court went back into another expansive phase, you could say.
Well, they did. The pendulum swung the other way now. Now the Courts of Appeals getting the new message that they should be very cautious and conservative in defining what's a security. Started to say, no, they're not securities, and the Supreme Court started to reverse them again. So you have this long series of cases in which the Supreme Court are reversing courts of appeals mm-hmm. one way or the other.
Yeah.
So the pendulum swung back into what was probably another expansive phase,
mm-hmm.
and there were several cases in that phase. I could go into many of them, but I'll skip a few of them. One was a case which involved the sale of 100% of the stock in a corporation. And you know, many companies are organized different ways. Some are organized as partners, some sole owners will operate it as a DBA, doing business as, filing it with their local county clerk's office. And some will set up a corporation, and they'll issue 100% of the stock to themselves. So when that kind of a company sells 100% of the stock, a sole owner company selling 100% of the stock to another purchaser, is that sale of a stock a security covered by the securities laws? Well, over the years, 10 courts of appeals around the country decided that case, and 5 of them held yes, it was, and 5 of them held no, it wasn't. And the argument was made that this is a sale of a business, and the so-called sale of a business doctrine precluded it from being a security. And the others said, well, stock is stock, and if it meets the requirements as defined by the Supreme Court, transferability, negotiability, limited liability, and so on, why, then it is stock. The Supreme Court finally took the case to resolve what's sometimes called conflicts in circuits, and the SEC was in there supporting that it was a stock. Supreme Court held, yes, it is stock, and held that it was then subject to the securities laws. Another case was Reeves versus Arthur Young, and in that case, the question was whether a certain note was a security. The securities laws say notes are securities, but not all notes are securities. And without going into detail, there are a lot of exceptions to the circumstances under which a note can be a security. And these were transactions between banks, between very sophisticated entities. And the Supreme Court held that, yes, that was a note and it was a security. So you do have, as I say, this variety of cases on that subject. And the SEC did support, in Reeves, the argument that that note was a security. Okay.
Is it fair to say that, in general, the SEC takes positions in favor of a more expansive definition of securities?
I would say the answer to that is yes. Part of the reason is that issue is what is called jurisdictional. That is, if the transaction or the document is a security, then the SEC has jurisdiction over it. If it is held not to be a security, why, the SEC has no jurisdiction, because the SEC deals only in securities. And if a Supreme Court case would hold that the transaction would not be a security, that would mean, in effect, that the SEC was no longer entitled to police those kinds of transactions. So as an interest in its own jurisdiction, the SEC commonly has taken an expansive position mm-hmm. on what is covered.
Can you think of any counterexamples to that, maybe an instance in which the SEC took a position either before the court or an amicus brief that a contract or something was not a security?
I can think of other examples in which the SEC has taken positions against the interest of investors, but I can't off the top of my head remember a case in which the SEC did that.
Okay. You obviously still follow cases before the Supreme Court. Do you think that the Supreme Court has already said its last word on the definition of securities, or is this likely to come back up?
Well, I think it will be one of these eternal issues, because without going into detail, cases that never reached the Supreme Court held a huge variety of things to be securities. For example, pyramid promotion schemes, you know, where you bring in somebody to sell cosmetics or sell something, and when you bring him in, you get a bonus. Those have been held to be securities. Whiskey warehouse receipts, where you put whiskey in a warehouse and you get a receipt for the whiskey, and now you're not selling whiskey, but you're selling receipts back and forth. Those have been held to be securities. Certain coin programs have been held to be securities. So mm-hmm. wherever there's an opportunity for investment, and really somebody else is doing the work, and the investor is really passive, those are securities. And the SEC has been pretty vigorous in arguing that those are securities.
Okay. Okay. Okay, let's move on a little bit and talk about civil liabilities and the implied rights of action. What laws and SEC rules govern this area?
Well, the implied right of action, of course, focuses on the word implied. There are, in the securities laws, express actions that are set forth. That is, for violation of the laws, investors have the right to go to court to sue. Some of these remedies are effective. Some, as a practical matter, are not very effective. But there has grown up the question as to whether other SEC laws, which themselves do not have rights of action, nonetheless allow investors to sue on them. And we call those implied rights of action, or the implication of a right of action. And these, of course, are by definition all private actions, not SEC actions. So when the SEC participates in these cases, they're always participating as amicus. These are not the SEC's own cases. And there was in this area also an expansive period, and like in the definition of securities, then a more restrictive period. In the expansive period, early on, you dealt with a very famous section of the federal securities laws, Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act, which is generally an anti-fraud section. And then a rule that was passed by the SEC in 1942. Statute was passed in 1934, the rule in 1942, and there's no suggestion that at either of those times Congress or the SEC ever thought it was granting an express action to investors. But in 1946, a trial court in Pennsylvania held that if someone violated that rule and investor was injured, why the investors could sue that person. And that came out of a common law doctrine that said that if there's a right in the law, then there should be a remedy for violation of that right. So that was a famous tort doctrine that was in the common law for centuries. And that was adopted by the federal courts. And based on that, there were a series of cases that developed causes of action. There was a case called J.I. Case versus Borak, which found that if there was proxy fraud in a proxy, asking investors to vote for boards of directors, then that was actionable, and investors could bring a lawsuit. And then a case called Superintendent of Insurance versus Bankers Life that also held that under 10B, Section 10B I referred to, in Rule 10B-5, there was an implied rights of action. And thereafter, there were many, many cases in the Supreme Court that set forth elements of this private right of action without any analysis as to whether this really private right of action existed. So you had embroidery on something which was not statutory and which was all judge-made. So you had a case where the court held that you have to be a purchaser, a seller of securities. This is the blue chip case. In that case, the issuer of securities had defrauded buyers of stock. And the remedy was that they had to offer rescission. That is, they had to offer the stockholders a right to get their money back. And in the offer of rescission, there was fraud again. So people were induced not to take that offer. And the issue then arose as to whether persons who don't buy or don't sell, but merely hold stock based on fraud, have a right to sue. And the Supreme Court said, no, they don't, because the law says you have to be a purchaser or a seller. And since persons who are merely holders are neither purchasers nor sellers, the Supreme Court said there would be no remedy.
So the SEC filed an amicus brief on this.
We did, in which we supported the right of defrauded holders of security to sue, but the Supreme Court said no.
Did you work on the preparation of that?
I did help on that. In the case that I argued, called Ernst & Ernst versus Hockfelder, this case involved a question as to whether negligence would be a sufficient basis for liability, and the Supreme Court held no, that would not be enough, that you need that the wrongdoer had to act with scienter, which it described as a mental state embracing an intent to defraud, manipulate, or deceive. So unless the person had this bad mental state, the person would not be liable for securities fraud. The court went on to say that that could sometimes be established by recklessness. You wouldn't have to have actual knowledge, and many cases then held that scienter was established by recklessness. The SEC argued in that case that negligence would have been sufficient.
Okay. And were there any other cases during your time as a solicitor that concerned this issue of implied rights of action?
Well, there was a case called Piper versus Criffcraft. This was a tender offer case. And instead of the shareholders suing for violation of the tender offer rules and fraud in the tender offer documents, the one who sued was the disappointed bidder. That is, the one who lost out to someone else in a tender offer. And the Supreme Court held that there was no standing in a disappointed bidder to sue for violation of the tender offer rules because they were designed to protect investors and not bidders. The SEC did not participate in that case.
Mm-hmm. What about the Huddleston case?
The Huddleston case is a case I had also argued. That was a case involving the so-called overlap of remedies. In that case, there were two remedies involved. One was Section 10B that I referred to, a very broad blunderbuss remedy. And the other was Section 11 of the Securities Act of 1933. Section 11 gives remedies for persons who are defrauded in the offer of sale of securities, usually in the initial offer of securities. For various technical reasons, Section 11 was not available in this case. So the issue was a very interesting issue. If Congress had carefully delineated, as it did in Section 11, who could sue, what the remedies would be, how much the recovery would be, which persons were liable, what the statute of limitations would be, and so on, then Congress was, the argument went, expressly saying that it wanted Section 11 to apply to these kinds of cases. So to overlay Section 10B on that with none of those limitations or restrictions would be wrong. Court, however, held that Section 10B did apply and said that the overlap of sections is not unfortunate and that 10B could apply even though other sections as well apply. But that was a win for investors and certainly for the SEC, which supported them.
Okay, great. Were there any other cases that you'd like to talk about in this regards?
I think it probably is worth just a mention or two about the insider trading cases. These are cases, for the most part, which were SEC party cases, SEC sued. But there are a handful of cases where private investors sued as well. And insider trading is not defined in the securities law or in any SEC rule. So it grew up, decided case by case in the courts and administrative decisions of the administrative law judges. And there were several cases that went to the Supreme Court that helped define and shape the doctrines and the theories of insider trading. And I was involved in several of those. I argued one case called Dirks versus the SEC. Back, I guess, in the early 70s. And then handled the last case I handled before I left the SEC in 1998 was a case called U.S. versus O'Hagan, a criminal insider trading case. in which the Supreme Court upheld another theory of insider trading, the misappropriation theory of insider trading. So there are now two theories of insider trading, blessed by the courts, but found nowhere in the statute. And even today, and we're talking now in 2011, there still is no definition of insider trading in the law or in any SEC rule, but many, many cases on it, on the subject. So really, if you want to know the law, you have to go to the case books and read those decisions.
Were there any cases before the Supreme Court that dealt with civil liability in the case of misstatements? Or were those more in the circuit courts?
No, there were some. There were some cases. There was a case called, one of my favorite cases, called the Affiliated Ute case. The Affiliated Ute case. Affiliated Ute was an Indian tribe in Alaska, and they had been given under federal law certain rights to stock in certain companies. And there were several banks up in Alaska that were making a market in the stock, that is, they were buying stock and selling stock, and they had actually two markets. They had what was referred to as the white man's market, and they had a market called the Indian's market. The white man's market was, the prices were much higher in. And so when the Indians went to buy stock or to sell their stock and get money, they were dealing in a lower priced market. And the bank never told the Indians about this white man's market. And the Supreme Court held that that was a violation of law. And I used to teach securities law at Georgetown Law School for many years. And when I taught this case, I always used to say, never stand mute before an affiliated ute. And while it sounds corny, students always remember that phrase. So it's one of these cliches you try to give to help a student remember a case.
That sounds like a good way to do it. Let's talk about cases that were not directly related to securities, but that were nonetheless considered important to the SEC's work. Did the SEC participate in cases that were not related to securities?
Yes, they did. The SEC used to really watch all the cases that went to the Supreme Court, even in other areas of the law. And the reason for that is that sometimes these cases would have an indirect implication for SEC cases.
How did you do that? Did you have a staff of interns or clerks that would be charged with monitoring everything that came out of the Supreme Court, or would you?
Well, it was, yes, we did monitor all the cases that went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, when it granted search, or granted certiorari, or review as it's called, would do so in very public ways. So you'd have newspaper reports, and you're really talking only about 80 to 100 cases a year, so it really isn't that many. We did monitor those cases, and sometimes we would not be a party or couldn't really be an amicus in those kinds of cases. They weren't securities cases. We would try to persuade the Solicitor General to put language in the Solicitor General's brief or the other agency's brief that might be helpful to the SEC, so that we look particularly at cases involving the banking laws, the commodity laws, cases that were sort of in the neighborhood of the SEC work. We used to call this the greater SEC metropolitan area interest. There's one case that's probably worth talking about, which is Equal Employment Opportunity Commission versus Arabian American Oil Company.
This was in the early 90s.
Right. This is called EEOC versus Aramco, Aramco being the way that that company was referred to. And in that case, the issue arose as to whether the Civil Rights Act, which provided against discrimination in employment, applied to U.S. citizens employed by a U.S. oil company, but in Saudi Arabia. And the lingo that's sometimes used is whether just these civil rights laws on anti-discrimination and employment would apply extraterritorially. The SEC was concerned about this case because the SEC chases crooks all over the world. It tries to find money that's hidden all over the world. And it applies its laws extraterritorially in that sense. We were afraid that if the Supreme Court would hold, and we thought it was going to hold, that these civil rights laws did not apply outside the United States, that thereafter we would be faced in court cases, our own court cases, with defendants saying, well, look, the Supreme Court said that there is no extraterritorial jurisdiction. So we went to the Solicitor General, and we actually went to the Department, we went to the Antitrust Division, which had the same concerns because it was applying its antitrust laws extraterritorially. And we said, we'd like to put something in the government's brief on this subject. The government was opposing the extraterritorial reach of the civil rights law, of the civil rights law in that case. We'd like to put something in the government's brief that reserves the extraterritorial power in the SEC and the antitrust laws. And they agreed to that. So we wrote up some material which was put in that brief, and it worked very well. The Supreme Court held, as we had expected, that the civil rights laws did not apply overseas, but said in their opinion that it is well recognized that the securities laws do apply extraterritorially. So that's an example of one case in which was quite successful.
I can imagine that other agencies within the government were concerned about this as well. The Justice Department, for instance.
Yes, they were concerned about this. But we wanted to be specific enough to have language that wasn't general language, but also language that said that the securities laws would apply. And the reason was that while the Justice Department may have been concerned, they were on the other side. Their concern was against extraterritoriality. And the SEC's concern was for extraterritoriality. But they were amenable to putting the highly specific language in the brief, which worked.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Were there any other cases you'd like to talk about, perhaps Morrison versus Olson?
Well, that's kind of a complicated case, but I guess I will. In Morrison versus Olson, the issue was whether the special counsel, which no longer exists, but there was a law at that time, giving the special counsel the right to investigate and prosecute government officials for wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. And the special counsel could be removed only for cause. That is, that the Attorney General or the President could not remove the special counsel unless the special counsel did something wrong. That the special counsel was not serving at will, like, say, the Attorney General serves. And the issue then was sort of a very highly technical issue as to whether you could have that kind of a system in the government where you had high officials that were not being able to be removed at will by the President or by the Attorney General. The reason for the SEC's interest was, around that time, defense lawyers were arguing in SEC cases that these cases could not be brought by SEC lawyers, they had to be brought by Department of Justice lawyers. And that was because the five commissioners, the chairman and the commissioners of the SEC, serve for fixed terms. And they can be removed only for cause and not at the will of the president. And therefore, this became, they said, a constitutional issue. Article 2 of the Constitution provides that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. This is a so-called take care clause, and the defense lawyers argued in SEC cases that since the SEC commissioners who approved these enforcement lawsuits could not be removed by the president, then the president was not able to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. They said, on the other hand, the Attorney General can be removed by the President for any reason. Therefore, it has to be his lawyers or the Department of Justice lawyers that bring these cases. The SEC's argument, of course, was that the president can take care that the laws be faithfully executed in many other ways other than having the ability to remove the officials of the agency that authorized these lawsuits. Well, when this special counsel case, Morrison versus Olson, came up, we felt that we wanted to come in there and support the notion that someone like the special counsel, who can be removed only for cause, nonetheless, is a valid person. And the court held, yes, it was. So that was our interest in that case. There's some interesting footnotes. Morrison, the plaintiff, was Alexia Morrison, who had been the chief trial counsel for the SEC at an earlier stage in her career. And the Olson was the very famous Theodore Olson, who was later becoming Solicitor General and who had argued Bush versus Gore in the Supreme Court. So you had
quite a mix of personalities.
She was trying to, you know, say he had done bad things. Mm-hmm. Eventually, she dropped the case, even after her authority was upheld.
So how would you describe the interaction between the SEC and other agencies of government in regards to Supreme Court actions? Was it generally positive, or were there times at which you conflicted?
I would say that they've been generally positive. The SEC has enjoyed over the years, and in my tenure there, which was over 35 years, very good relations with the Solicitor General personally and with his staff. The Solicitor General's staff is usually composed of younger lawyers who had a stint as clerks to Supreme Court justices. Some of them stayed on, others moved on, but they were generally very bright and very good lawyers. And over the years, they often told me that they thought that the SEC's appellate shop was the best appellate lawyers of any agency in the government. Of course, not including the Solicitor General's office, which they always said, of course, was number one. So we did have, the SEC did have and still has very good relations with the SEC. Sometimes it would get into disputes with other agencies, and I mentioned earlier the dispute in the Green Bank case about the definition of security, whether a C bank CD was a security, and how the bank agencies, the SEC, disagreed, and how the Solicitor General tried to work that out.
How much of this depended on the personality of the SG, and how much of it was, I guess, related to the subject area in which there were natural conflicts between the interests of, say, the Justice Department and the SEC?
I would say that I think it almost always depended on the merits. Mm-hmm. I never thought that individual solicitor generals were trying to make personal points. Mm-hmm. I think they conscientiously agreed or disagreed with the views of the SEC. And for the great majority of cases, they generally did agree, or at least went along with the SEC's positions. The SEC, the Solicitor General, likes to say, as I mentioned before, that this cliche that the government speaks with one voice in the Supreme Court, and that, of course, is his voice. The independent agencies like to say, and certainly the SEC is vigorous in saying, that when it has a construction of its own statute, it thinks it ought to be able to go to the Supreme Court and give its views as to how its own statute that it administers ought to be interpreted. And so you have, to some extent, this sort of philosophical difference, which rarely comes up, but sometimes does come up. One example of where it came up was a very famous insider trading case that I had argued in the early 80s called Dirks versus SEC. And this was a case in which the then Solicitor General, who was Rex Lee, very fine man, disagreed with the SEC's position in that case. And Dirks had lost in the D.C. Circuit, that is the Federal Appeals Court in the District of Columbia, and he was the one who asked the Supreme Court for review. So at what we call the certiorari stage, certiorari being the fancy name in which one asks for review, and sometimes it's called cert, you know, cert is sought or cert is denied or cert is granted. At that stage, while the Solicitor General disagreed with the SEC's position, it allowed the SEC to oppose the petition for review and to argue its position in that opposition. But the Solicitor General added a footnote stating his view that the SEC position was in error. Then, after the court decided to take the case, a dispute arose between the SEC and the Solicitor General. And I said that an independent agency, as I mentioned before, ought to be able to go and express its view to the Supreme Court as to the proper construction of a statute that it administers. And he said he disagreed with that, and that he represents the government and the Supreme Court, and he's not going to let the SEC file a brief supporting its position. So we had a little to-do back and forth about this, and I told him that I would recommend to the SEC commissioners that they authorize me to file a brief on behalf of the SEC and the Supreme Court, whether he'd like it or not. And his response to me was that he would not authorize the filing of that brief, and he thought the Supreme Court clerk would not accept it for filing if it did not include an endorsement on it that the Solicitor General approved of his filing. I then said that the SEC would then file with the Supreme Court a document called a petition for writ of mandamus, fancy words for saying that a request that the court direct the clerk to accept the brief for filing. This procedure, of course, would then require the court to decide whether or not it was going to let the SEC file a brief, and maybe be precedent for the question as to whether individual agencies can submit briefs in their own cases when the SEC differs on the merits. So apparently not wishing for that test case, the SG then acceded to the SEC filing its own brief.
Well, did this itself set a precedent, maybe not in legal terms, but in terms of just practice?
Well, as a practical matter, no, because of subsequent arguments, the SG's positions hardened on that. So this time, the Solicitor General filed its own amicus brief, interestingly enough, not a party brief, the SEC was a party, filed an amicus brief, setting forth its opposition to the SEC interpretation, but at the SEC's request, his brief did include some generalized statements of support for the SEC's insider trading program. Hmm. We wanted to make sure, and he agreed, that his brief focused narrowly on the issue, and he wasn't opposed generally to the insider trading program. So I presented oral argument on behalf of the SEC in the Supreme Court. The Solicitor General did not present argument, just relied on his brief. And the SEC lost that case, but not on the ground the SG had asserted. The Supreme Court completely ignored his position and simply went for Mr. Dirks on his position. But notwithstanding that, the relations remained good between the SG, Solicitor General, as we like to refer to him, and the SEC, even in other cases. Rex Lee was a very good man, and good-natured guy, and I don't think there were any personal animosities that resulted from that.
Mm-hmm. Besides that, everyone could remain professional.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
I liked him because he used to run, he used to jog during the lunch hour. Mm-hmm. So you'd see this guy, he's a younger man in those days, he would run down the mall, and sometimes run into him on the mall. I used to be a jogger too, and we used to chit-chat.
Ah. So were there any disagreements with other agencies in cases that concerned the definitions of security? For instance, in the case of Marine Bank?
Well, we talked about Marine Bank and how they, how the SG put us in his conference room and locked the door and said, you guys aren't coming out till you come to an agreement. There was another dispute between the SEC and the Solicitor General in a case called 1987, CTS versus Dynamics, where the United States and the SEC were amicus in private action and not a party. And the question arose as to whether the Indiana Control Share Acquisition Act, sometimes called a state anti-takeover statute, violated the Constitution and should be struck down. And both the SEC and the Solicitor General agreed that this statute, Indiana statute, violated the Commerce Clause in the U.S. Constitution, but we disagreed as to whether the Williams Act, which is the federal statute dealing with takeovers that the SEC regulates, preempted the Indiana state law. Today in the Supreme Court, I've been reading the newspapers, there are a great many preemption cases. That is, that whether federal law means that the state law will not apply. And we had argued in lower courts, in courts of appeals, many times that the Williams Act defanged, took away the power of these state anti-takeover statutes. He disagreed with that. And so we worked out a compromise, which I thought was a very subtle compromise. So on the Commerce Clause issue, the brief that was filed jointly on behalf of the United States and the SEC said that the SEC and the United States believes that the Indiana law violates the Commerce Clause, but on the preemption issue, rather than note the SEC's differing view, the brief simply asserted that the United States believes that the Indiana law is not preempted by the Williams Act. So a careful reader of the brief might infer that the mention only of the United States and not of the SEC and the United States signaled the SEC disapproval of the SG's views on the preemption argument. And although I thought this was very subtle, no time at all the newspapers, the trade publications, and later the law reviews all pointed that out. It wasn't that subtle at all.
Right.
But that was it was sort of a compromise to avoid, you know, a big argument.
So how did the court rule on that?
The court ruled that the statute, I'm trying to remember, statute, I think, survived.
Yep. So it ruled that it was not a violation of the Commerce Clause.
I believe it did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so united in defeat, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Yes.
And then another example, which was here a dispute between agencies, where the Solicitor General, this was Kenneth Starr, with whom I had very close relations, and we had a great many cases together. He would not offer a compromise on this case. This involves a case called in the Seventh Circuit, that, as I mentioned, is the Federal Courts of Appeals in Chicago, titled Chicago Mercantile Exchange versus SEC in 1990. This involved the SEC's grant of permission to stock exchanges to trade so-called index participations as securities. The CFTC, Commodities Futures Trading Commission, that's the agency that regulates commodities, had successfully opposed this SEC interpretation before the Seventh Circuit, arguing that these index participations were commodities subject to CFTC and not SEC regulation. And the Seventh Circuit, as I said, agreed with that. Unfortunately for the SEC, the Commodities Exchange Act has a winner-take-all clause. It says that if certain things are commodities, then it doesn't make any difference whether they're also securities, then they win. Mm-hmm. So consequently, even though these index participations could have been securities, if they're also commodities, then there's exclusive jurisdiction in the Commodity Exchange Act. Yet the Solicitor General agreed with the CFTC on the merits because of this exclusive jurisdiction provision and opposed the SEC's attempt to go to the Supreme Court. for review in this case, even though the SEC, of course, was a named party in the case. The Solicitor General did not allow the SEC to file its own brief. Instead, the SG wrote its own brief, in which it summarized the SEC's views, but rejected them. I had argued the Seventh Circuit case, and I pressed Solicitor General Starr hard to get to the Supreme Court. I said to him, in effect, well, you know, you may agree or disagree, but this is an important issue, and we should let the Supreme Court decide that. He said, no, he's not going to let that happen. But to his credit, he was very careful to present the SEC's views accurately in the brief, and he gave me opportunities to read the draft and to comment on it. But still in all, he adhered to his position. There's an interesting personal epilogue, which maybe I don't know whether it fits or not, but sort of would like to tell. You finally reach a point, or at least I did, where you know that you lost. You know, I've lost the game. This was on the Friday before a Memorial Day weekend. And my wife and I were going for the weekend to Point Lookout, Maryland, a very nice state park where the Potomac River goes into Chesapeake Bay. And we had our kayaks on our car and our tent in the back. And we do this frequently. We go out there, we were going to tent, camp, and then we were going to go kayaking. And unfortunately, because I was being delayed in Judge Starr's office, I didn't get out in time early enough to meet my wife. So we got off late, and we got to Point Lookout. It's early when it was getting dark already. It was starting to rain, and we had to pitch our tent as quickly as we could before it got into deluge. And while we were doing that, we hear a siren. And a Maryland State Trooper with his light, revolving on top of his car, comes up to our campsite. And he says to me, "Are you Paul Gonson?" And I said, "Yes, what did I do wrong?" And he said, "Well, I have a very important message. The Solicitor General of the United States wants you to call him." I said, "My gosh, how did you find me?" Anyway, the short answer was that my wife's mother was living with us, and of course we always wanted her to know where we were, so we left a phone number, and I guess somehow or other, Star found where we were. But anyway, I said, "Well," these were the days before cell phones, I said, "Is there a phone around here someplace?" She said, "Well, about 3 miles from here, on a telephone pole, there's a phone, an outdoor phone. I'll drive you there, I'll lead you there." So I followed him in the car. Now it's pouring rain and it's dark. And Starr is still in his office and he's still working on the brief, which has to be filed, as I said, the Monday after Memorial Day. And he's made some language changes. And he wants to run those language changes by me to make sure I don't have any objection. At that point, of course, I had lost the war. And he read that. I think that was very gracious of him to offer to do that. But it didn't work well with my wife, who had to put up the tent all by herself in the dark and in the rain. Anyway.
That's a great story. So apparently the work of the solicitor does not end at his office doorstep.
That's right.
Job never done. So, great. And Chicago Mercantile was fought in the Seventh Circuit Court,
right.
Correct?
Right.
Yeah. Was it Judge Easterbrook that decided the case?
It was Judge Easterbrook, yes, uh-huh. Very famous Judge Easterbrook. He was, in an earlier era, a deputy solicitor general with whom I had worked on a number of cases, including a case called Edgar versus Mice, which was a forerunner to the so-called second-generation anti-state, anti-takeover statutes, he had argued that case. He thereafter became a law professor at the University of Chicago, became part of the so-called Chicago School, with Judge Posner, who also taught at that time, and they both ended up on the Seventh Circuit, very conservative, but very good judges.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that it made a big difference whether or not a judge had a background in securities law?
Yes, indeed. I thought that was very important. And usually the courts that did tend to get it right. Sometimes, you know, I would lose a case and I would sort of reflect and say, you know, in the deepest, innermost recesses of my heart and mind, that the case probably was right even though I lost. Because you have a client, which was, of course, the SEC, and you did your best to try to support them in the courts, and sometimes on reflection, maybe the way they decided things wasn't always the best way. Sometimes judicial review is a good thing to point that out. So, but I did find that courts in the Second Circuit, where many, many of these securities cases are held, and trial judges are really very sophisticated in the securities laws. They get many of these cases, and they're very, very good. And that's true generally in the big cities, true in Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, where there are big centers of securities laws, and less so out in the hinterlands. Although I think conscientiously federal judges who are generalists, they try every kind of case imaginable. They try criminal cases, they try patent cases, they try antitrust cases. So they do their best in every case they have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we've talked about your long, distinguished career at the SEC. Let's talk a little bit about what came afterwards. So you entered into private practice. Did you continue working on issues related to the Supreme Court after leaving the SEC?
Well, I did. I had several Supreme Court cases. As I mentioned, I left the SEC in 1998 and went to a private law firm where I've been for now over 12 years and now semi-retired. And a few years ago, there was a very interesting case, and I think it also is now, of course, I'm on the other side, representing a stockbroker. I used to like to say that for many years I sued stockbrokers, and now I defend them. But, of course, the same law applies. In this case was a case that dealt in its own way with a dispute between the SEC and the Solicitor General, who was Paul Clement. And this case is called the Credit Suisse versus Billing case, decided in 2007. In this case, of course, I did not represent the SEC. I represented one of the defendants in the case. The case was brought under the antitrust laws, not the securities laws, but the alleged conduct was all securities related. And it was a very, very big case. It was a class action brought by thousands of investors against 10 of the largest investment banking firms in the country.
And this case was Credit Suisse Securities v. Billing.
That's correct. And I represented one of these 10 firms. The firms had formed underwriting syndicates to sell shares of stock in initial public offerings of hundreds of high-tech companies between 1997 and 2000. In early 2000, as I'm sure everyone will recall, this high-tech bubble burst and the market value of these stocks tumbled down, losing billions and even trillions of dollars in value. So these thousands of investors formed a class action and brought this antitrust suit and claimed that these 10 underwriting firms had unlawfully conspired with each other in violation of the antitrust laws, and that they would not sell shares of a popular new issue of stock, so-called hot issue, unless the buyer agreed to pay so-called anti-competitive charges over and above the share price in one of or more of three ways. First, that the buyer had to agree to buy additional shares of the same security at even higher prices. This is so-called a practice called laddering. Or they had to pay unusually high commissions on subsequent securities purchasers from the underwriters. So when they bought more stock, they would have to pay very, very high commissions sort of a kickback arrangement. Or three, that they would have to purchase less desirable securities in order to get the desirable ones, a practice in antitrust law called tying. And this alleged conspiracy was said to raise the prices artificially. So in the trial court, the defendants made a motion to dismiss the antitrust action on the ground that all of the conduct was securities related, and the federal securities laws outlawed this alleged conduct and dealt effectively with this kind of case. And so we argued that the securities laws implicitly precluded the antitrust laws to this conduct. And we did say that if anybody was going to bang the heads of these people, the SEC was supposed to do it, not the antitrust people. And secondly, that you could bring these cases under the securities laws. The reason they were brought under the antitrust laws is that under the securities laws, you get single damages. Under the antitrust laws, if you win, you get treble damages. That is, the damages are, you get three times the amount of damages. Furthermore, the antitrust cases are much easier to win than securities cases because the securities cases have elaborate protections that Congress has given and statutes to prevent abuses. And these statutes, of course, would not apply to antitrust cases. So it was advantageous to bring the cases in the antitrust field. When we made the motion to dismiss, sort of a preemption motion that the securities laws preempted the antitrust laws, the trial court then sent a request to the SEC and a separate request to the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, asking each of them to file an amicus brief expressing their views. The SEC's brief said that the motion to dismiss should be granted, and it says so to protect its own jurisdiction. The Antitrust Division brief said the motion should be denied and that the case should proceed under the antitrust laws. Their view was that if conduct violates two laws, both laws should apply. The trial court granted the motion and dismissed the case. On appeal, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals also asked the agencies each to file an amicus brief, and they each told the Second Circuit the same position that they had in the trial court. The Court of Appeals, however, reversed the trial court and held that the case should proceed under the antitrust laws, sent the case back to be processed under the antitrust laws. The defendants then asked the Supreme Court to take the case, and the Supreme Court did. The Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals, and it held that the securities laws did oust the antitrust laws. So when the case got to the Supreme Court, the SEC, the Solicitor General, then was faced with two agencies already on record asserting opposite positions. And neither agency was a party to the case. The case, of course, was a private action. So after much negotiation, as you can imagine, the Solicitor General refused to let the SEC file this brief in the Supreme Court. Instead, the SEC filed a brief on behalf of the United States, agreeing in part with the SEC, agreeing in part with the Antitrust Division, satisfying neither agency, and it attempted to set forth a middle ground. Now, even though the SEC could not file a brief in the Supreme Court, its views were well known, and the Supreme Court, and what I thought was stunning in its opinion, quotes favorably from the SEC's brief filed in the district court. So even though the SEC didn't get to file a brief in the Supreme Court, it set forth its views very well in the district court, trial court, and we, the defendants, took pains to put that entire brief in our appendix in the Supreme Court, which is a little booklet that gives the opinions of the courts below and the briefs that were filed and so on. And when the Supreme Court cites to the SEC's brief, it cites to those pages in the appendix where it was set forth, mm-hmm. So it worked very well. Then, with regard to the Solicitor General's brief, the Supreme Court said, and I'm quoting now, "We are aware that the Solicitor General, while recognizing the conflict, suggests a procedural device that he believes will avoid it," parentheses, "in effect, a compromise between the differing positions that the SEC and the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice took in the courts below, unquote. And then the Supreme Court says, quote, the Solicitor General's proposed disposition, however, does not convincingly address the concerns we have set forth, unquote, and then rejects their position. So while this was an attempt bravely by the Solicitor General to work out some compromise, it didn't work, and the court holds four square on behalf of the position asserted by the Supreme Court.
So in your defense, you were able to exploit these differences between the positions
and the SEC. It was interesting that in our negotiations with the SEC, of course, the SEC was at pains to tell us and to tell everyone else that while we were on the same, that the SEC and the stockbrokers were on the same side, the SEC was not supporting them. Its purpose was its own concerns about which agency should regulate securities-related conduct. And I think maybe to some extent it could be viewed as a turf battle. Mm-hmm. That is that if there's going to be regulation of the securities markets, it ought to be done by the SEC and not by the Antitrust Division.
Do you recall any comparable experiences from your time as solicitor where you were in negotiations with one side or another of a case and it became clear that the position of the SEC was different from that of the SG? I mean, we already talked about cases where that had happened, but I was wondering if it was something that was discussed in negotiations with
there
parties involved.
There were some times where there were a couple of cases with banking agencies, generally, that never got to the point where we were actually going to file different positions in court. Generally, the SEC would then acquiesce. These were positions of less importance to the SEC. And there were times I remember that I was in conferences with general counsels and banking agencies and Solicitor General and staff where they would have one position, the SEC would differ somewhat with it, and eventually the SEC just sort of let it go. It would be interesting, for example, even today, you know, today less so. Not many years ago, if you went into a bank and you went up to the counter and you said, I want to open a savings account. And the teller said, well, have you ever considered buying some mutual funds? You get some more money in mutual funds than you can in a savings account. Now, this teller is not a stockbroker. And then if you express an interest, maybe you'd be sent off to somebody who's sitting at a desk at the bank and who then maybe would try to sell you some stock or mutual funds that the bank had an interest in. And we were concerned that investors might be confused by this, might believe that the FDIC insurance might include these non-bank investments, which of course they don't include. So over the years, various compromises were worked out. We wanted this guy at the desk to sit upstairs on the second floor, not in the bank lobby, not convey that misimpression. Compromise is that if you go to a bank today, they usually are in little separate offices, closed offices, but within the bank's lobby. You know, that's sort of compromise. Well, there were certain issues like that that were involved with some of the banking agencies. The banking agencies always were concerned about safety and soundness of the bank. So things were not going well with the banks, for example. The banking agencies' positions were that they didn't want that to be public because they didn't want the so-called run on the bank. You know, some depositors were concerned that maybe the safety and maybe the bank was in trouble. You'd have long lines, and the next morning, people wanting to withdraw their money. And, of course, no bank has that much cash. Their money is always invested or out in loans or mortgages. And that would be very bad, even though the FDIC insurance would cover. Most people want to get their money out. So the bank agencies tended to cover up. The SEC, on the other hand, is a disclosure agency. So if some of these banks were public companies, or their holding companies were public companies, that is, there were stockholders in these companies, then the SEC wanted that information out right away. And there would be negotiations that would go back and forth. It never rose quite to big hassles in the Solicitor General's office.
But this is very interesting. You're telling me that the layout of the bank, of the lobbies of banks today, is basically a result of negotiations between
today,
securities and banking regulators.
This is a compromise. They're not upstairs on the second floor where the SEC wanted them, but they were, you know, they're now walled off, if you will, from the tellers. And now all the banking literature has a big bold type: these investments are not insured by the U.S. government, which is another compromise. So, you know, these things work out.
Oh, that's really fascinating. So, yeah. Well, let's wrap up with some general reflections. In general, what was the attitude of the SEC towards bringing cases before the Supreme Court? Did it generally try to bring as many issues before the court as possible? Or?
Well, generally, it's sort of more or less of an appellate strategy to try to get cases there. It's more of an opportunistic reaction when they're there. After all, the cases get there not because the SEC is pushing them there, but because the court decides to take those 80 or 100 cases out of the 3,000 that are requested. Mm-hmm. So when the securities cases would get to the Supreme Court, or cases, as I mentioned, in our greater metropolitan neighborhood, why, the SEC would then go into them. But we believe that our goals, which was to try to be influential in shaping policy, have largely been successful, although there were, of course, up and down years over the years. Some cases were, some cases weren't. There were a couple scholars who wrote law review articles on this subject and pointed out that the SEC's one loss record really was very, very good in the Supreme Court. So I would think that we were quite influential in shaping policy, and these policy debates would, of course, echo in the halls of the agency itself, because often these are close cases. You can imagine that if the Supreme Court takes the case is by definition a close case, and there'll be reasonable people who will argue on both sides of that case. And as I mentioned, the one case where there was the so-called sale of business doctrine, where 10 courts of appeals have split 5-5.
That's Landreth v. Landreth.
Yes, you can easily see that there are, you know, differing opinions. Mm-hmm. So within the agency, we would have big fights about these cases. And I always used to thank God for deadlines. By that I mean that when you're in the Supreme Court, and your upside, that is, you are the petitioner, you have 45 days to file your brief, the time certiorari is granted. When your bottom side, that is, you're defending, then you have 30 days thereafter to file your brief. I think that if there were not those deadlines, these policy debates would never end. It's like rulemaking. Sometimes the SEC takes 2 years to get a rule passed. And that's because the lobbyists come in, the lawyers come in, Congress weighs in, everybody else weighs in, back and forth, and back and forth. If you've got 30 days or 45 days to file a brief, you've got to resolve your policy disputes in a hurry. So we all go to what they call the commission table. The commissioners sit, the five of them on one side, the relevant staff sits on the other side, and we discuss what the policy should be. And sometimes the staffs, within the staff, there may be disagreements about what that policy position would be. But whether for better or for worse, you've got to decide right away, because you've got to write that brief. You can't write the brief till you know what the policy is.
Thank God for deadlines.
Thank God for deadlines. So I used to love deadlines.
Can't live without them.
Yeah. Now, on a personal basis, if I could add that, because I sort of, you know, final thoughts. I love this work. You know, I found a home doing appellate work at the SEC. From a lawyer's point of view, I don't think there's anything as stimulating or professionally rewarding as Supreme Court practice. While it sometimes, you know, takes a long time for a case to get to the high court, and this example of the billing case, this antitrust case, I was in the case from the trial court to the Supreme Court. So the case started in, I don't know, 2003 or 4 or something, and ends up in 2007. Probably took 5 years to get to the high court. When you get there, as I said, you got 45 days to file your brief. So my personal satisfaction has always been a very high one. I think the SEC has been a great place to work anyway for everybody, but I think that doing Supreme Court work is the best. And as you pointed out, I was the solicitor of the agency for the last 20 years. My deputy, Jacob Stillman, succeeded me in that position when I left 12 years ago. And in the past 12 years, the SEC has enjoyed a very successful run during his tenure at the helm. Mr. Stillman came to the SEC in 1962. So this year, 2011, he's in his 49th year. And next year, God willing, he will spend 50 years at the SEC. So here's a guy up in years at the top of his game, doing the work that he loves and very, very successfully. And so I'm very proud of him, too.
Well, I think the general public probably owes all of you a big thanks for spending the many years of your careers in these positions serving the public.
Well, thank you. And I enjoyed this interview very much.